Longshot Ken here for non-productive.com. I have an incredible honor today. I was introduced recently to a 90s cult film, Samurai Cop. It's got a huge resurgence over the last couple of years. And on the line has to be one of the coolest, versatile men that I've had the pleasure of talking to in a long time. I have Mr. Mark Frazier on the phone with me. Mark, how are you today?
I'm doing pretty well, Ken.
Again, one of the things is I just recently found out about this Uber thing called Samurai Cop and what a resurgence it's had recently, and it's been all over the place. And you are so incredible in this movie. But I do want to go back a little bit because I know that you're not just an actor. I'd like to find out a little bit more about you growing up and stuff that you were into when you were younger. Like, you were an athlete, correct?
Yeah. I was a pretty good basketball player back there. Yeah, I grew up in Brooklyn. I went to Catholic school, and in fact, I was an all-city basketball player. In fact, I got, when I finished, I was like 13 all-city in New York, which is about 30 or so college scholarships.
Now, from there, how does that transition go from being an athlete? I mean, there had to be something else you were doing before you actually got your first acting gig, right? Like, what were you doing before you decided that you were going to get hit by the acting bug?
Okay, yeah, it's, I took a bit of a different route than most actors, I guess. Yeah, once I got out of Columbia, I got an MBA from Columbia, and I started at CBS as an executive. And I was there for about 7-8 years, I believe. I started in St. Louis, Missouri, and then I was promoted up to New York. I worked in New York City, at WCBS-TV, Channel 2. And so, you know, I said it was a lucrative job, made a lot of money, very prestigious, but the creativity wasn't there for me. I had seen that at the end. And again, so I met a person, and he was on television. His name was Leon Jones, and he's still a good friend of mine. I would see him on television, and then I would see him at clubs and everything. So we became pretty good friends. And so I started thinking about maybe I could do something like this, because, again, I really didn't know exactly what I wanted to do. I was I think I was a shy type of person. I'm an only child, so I thought maybe this will get me out of my shyness also. So, and also, you know, acting and athletics, there's a similarity to it. You use a lot of similar skills. And so I'm a strong believer in getting a structure together. So I went to acting class and to see if I could do this. And I did well in acting class. And in fact, I was with one of the best teachers in New York. He's taught everybody, you know, from Denzel Washington to Bruce Willis, Burt Reynolds, very, very good teacher. And even while I was in class, I started auditioning, and then I just hit. You know, I got a lot of commercials. I ended up on a soap opera working with Morgan Freeman. It was called Another World. It's not on the air now. But, this goes back a long ways. It's back.
Oh, yeah.
Morgan had black hair at that time. Tells you how far back that was. And so that's how I got involved. And I had a knack for it, it seemed. And then the more I studied, I did a lot of theater, the better and better I got it. And so that's how that began.
Now, do you remember what one of those first commercial gigs that you wound up getting were?
Yeah, the first commercial I ever got was for Sprite.
Oh, wow.
And, yeah, and it was a national spot. In fact, I celebrated when I got it. I got a limousine and took some of my friends out. And although when the commercial aired, it was only a 30-second spot, but I was in it. But later on, I did a lot of commercials, maybe probably over 50 in my entire career.
Did you ever get tired of seeing yourself on TV after a while?
I get tired of seeing myself on TV?
Well, I mean,
question?
If you're part of a national commercial, I mean, and it's playing all the time, did you ever turn the TV on and say, oh my God, here I am again?
No, because I get paid every time I see myself. I'm running forever. It's great to wake up sometime 12 o'clock in the afternoon and get a check in the mail, man.
That's awesome,
dude.
Like
hitting the lottery, you know? That's exactly how I was. It doesn't last forever, but it was good when it was running.
Yeah. Tell me, I mean, so you actually got to work directly with Freeman on Another World?
Oh, yeah, definitely, yeah. In fact, I'm in Jacksonville, Florida now. Eventually, I'm going to go back to California. But I have tapes of me and him working together. I haven't seen him in a long time, but they're stashed away in a box here in my room. I plan to, when I go back to L.A., since I have this resurgence of the Samurai Cop movies, it's just incredible. You know, I'm going to put a reel together and hit Hollywood again.
Well, you had just mentioned Samurai Cop. How did you wind up getting cast in that film?
That was an interesting story. Amir Sivan, who is no longer with us, he was the producer and director from Iran, and this is in the latter 80s and 90s, but it took like a year to shoot it because he ran out of money. You know, that's why this thing is so crazy, because, you know, Matt, who played my partner in Samurai Cop, he had a wig because he had cut off all his hair, and that's part of it. And also the dialogue was, because again, Amir is from Iran, so English was his second language, not his first. And he was a stickler for what he wrote. He wanted us to say what he said and what he wrote. So, I mean, that's why I came across as strange as it did. And how I got cast, I got a call. It came right through my agent. It came directly right to my house. So I picked up the phone, answered, and I think it was his secretary. Said, could you come down tomorrow and we're casting a film? We'd like for you to audition and see what happens. So the next day I go down there, and then I could see as I'm driving, I'm not going to like a business area. In fact, I went to a place, it's a city called Los Feliz, that's where Amir lived. He had his office in his house. So that was the first time I've ever auditioned in someone's house. And basically it really wasn't an audition. This is what happened. We shook hands, we exchanged pleasantries and smile, laugh and talk, and he was funny. So joked around, and then he said, okay, you're it. You're Frank Washington. And we're shooting tomorrow. I didn't have the script, so I just said yes, because I'm in an entire movie. So
it was just like that, huh?
Just like that, yeah. And we started shooting the next day, and I mean, it was tense, because I have never done a film of that magnitude where I'm on screen a lot, but I got through it. I used that nervous energy to do the first scene we did, and it came across pretty well. And then, you know, it was so much crazy stuff going on with Amir and the lack of money. You know, sometimes we shoot this, we had to run from the cops because he didn't have permits. It was just completely wild, man.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we finished it up, we thought, okay. And then, you know, then later on, I get a call from Matt. Matt was called Matt Hannon at that time. He's Matt Caritas now. He changed his last name. And he said, Mark, we have to go back.
Oh, geez.
And so that's why you see Matt with a wig. Sometimes you don't see him with his regular hair. So eventually, Amir just put everything together, and out of all this chaos came Samurai Cop.
Wow. Well, I want to ask you too. One of my favorite genre actors, Robert Zadar. Do you have any recollections? Because I mean, I know we lost him a couple of years ago, but do you have any recollections of working with him at all? Or
In fact, I only had really one scene with Rob. It was a restaurant scene, and there was a lot of people there, and he was in that scene. I don't know if you recall. Mm-hmm. But I didn't have anything one-on-one with him, but I just watched him work, you know, because sometimes he'd come out there. A lot of times we were outside shooting, so I would just watch him. He was extremely professional. He had done a number of films, I think, with Amir, you know, and he was like a cult favorite, as I learned later on. But I just really liked. He was a really nice guy. As I mentioned, he's very professional, and I learned a lot just by you know, watching him.
Yeah, and that's great, because again, thank you, because he's an actor that I had followed for years, and I don't get a chance with what I do on the show to be able to talk about him at all. So it's kind of cool to talk to someone who actually got a chance to work with him. I've hung out with him a couple times at show signings he was at, and we'd always go out for a drink, and very colorful person, we'll put it that way.
Yeah, that's him. Yeah, we tried to get him in Samurai Cop too, but you know. We couldn't work out until he passed. You know, so.
Well, how about we jump a little bit into Samurai Cop 2? We flash forward, what, 25 years after the original film?
Yeah, it was 25 years. Can you imagine? That's a story in itself there, too. Because at this time, I had been acting in the theater and getting little jobs here and there, but it was really, really tough. And then my mother, who was in Florida at the time, she wasn't feeling well. And I'm an only child, as I mentioned. And so I decided to stop acting and come down and take care of her. And so I came down here in Jacksonville, Florida. That's where I am right now. And spent time with her. And I was able to, you know, be with my mother for, in fact, I believe I helped her help. There's something to deal with her. Mm-hmm. And so she was alive for a longer period of time. But during this time, you know, because I had gotten rid of all my stuff in New York, because I knew I was going to be down here for a long period of time. I started getting all these emails from around the world talking about Samurai Cop. I couldn't believe it. This is you know, again, like after 25 years, it started all over again. And So I, obviously these, and I suck. I get fan mail every day. Usually when I go to the library, I hear from somebody somewhere around the world about Samurai Cop. So what happened during that time, I decided to just wonder about what was happening, because I would hear from a guy named Gregory Hatanaka, who directed and produced the second one, and told me about the buzz about what's going on with Samurai Cop. So I decided to fly to Los Angeles, because they were going to have a midnight screening of the movie. And so I flew to L.A., and then I went to the screening, and it was at 12 o'clock midnight, as I mentioned, and the place was packed. And it's a Newark theater, which is right around the corner from where I used to live. And I passed this theater so many times, I never knew that I would be appearing at that theater. And it seats about 400 to 600 people, man. It's a really, really big theater.
Wow.
And the place was packed with all these Samurai Cop fans. It was interesting. It was really, it was just crazy, man.
Is it one of those weird, surreal type of moments where it's like, it's been 25 years and all of a sudden, like, your film is packing theaters? Do you have that moment where you're like, man, I made it? It's incredible.
Well, yeah, it was like, initially it was, I just couldn't believe it. You know, I couldn't believe it. And when I came back, because I came back to Florida to tell my mother, and I told her, I said, Ma, this is really something. This film that I did, this crazy film I did 25 years ago, is a hit now. And they're planning to do a second one. So she said, wow. I don't know if I thought like I made it at that time. Because in New York, I told you I was on this soap, and, you know, in New York's a walking town. I was on this soap for a number of months, so I got recognized a lot in New York during that time. So, I thought maybe then I had made it. But then when I went out to L.A., it was a completely different ball game. But then again, like,
yeah.
So I looked at it like it's an up-and-down situation. But this Samurai Cop, it just tends to, I think it's going to live forever, because, again, you know, I hear from people all the time, every day. Every day I hear from people. So they're playing it somewhere around the world.
There's something bizarre. Like, once something hits the cultural zeitgeist and, you know, you hit that pop culture point, regardless of how long it takes, you're right. I think it's something that just stays forever. I mean, you look at movies like the Rocky Horror Picture Show and all these other films that have, like, late night screenings that weren't critically acclaimed or even, you know, seen a lot at that point, that just the right people find it and just pass it around. And before you know it, it's just everywhere. It's really kind of cool.
Right. And it's a fan cult situation. You know, like when we did the second one, went to Kickstarter, and fans put up their own money to see us again, to do the second one, you know.
And that's like the ultimate true testament. When you have fans saying, take my money and make this movie, you know?
Right. And they're clamoring, you know, for Samurai Cop 3. So it's still up in the air. We don't know what's going to happen, but I believe one day that'll be made too. And it's going to be a little different from Samurai Cop 2. I think we're probably going to go back to the genre of Samurai Cop 1 to try to get that feel.
I wanted to ask you about that, because that second film took an extreme detour from the original. I mean,
right.
It got crazy. Can you tell me a little bit about what it was like on that set? Because, like, it was just such a surreal, bizarre type film. And just the secondary cast, too, were just, I can't even put the right words into what I felt when I first saw that movie. But what was it like for you being on the set of it?
Again, it was chaos, but different chaos than from the first one. The reason why I believe the first one is so successful with all the oddities is that I always use the word linear. Acting friend of mine uses that word. He says, yeah, you can follow it from the beginning to the middle to the end.
Mm-hmm.
See, I think with Samurai Cop 2 and with Gregory Hatanaka, I believe he's a really good businessman, because he had to juggle all these different personalities. And I believe he brought in all these different people to bring in their audiences. You know, like Bai Ling is Chinese. He's got a strong Chinese backing. And,
right.
And this guy Tommy Wiseau, his backing, which in the long run, to me, it didn't work. Because it took away from really the relationship between myself and Matt, because I really believe that's what people wanted to see, you know.
Well,
and so we had to, at the end, you know, there's a scene that Matt and I are talking, and I'm trying to convince him during the film, I'm looking for him because we haven't seen each other in 25 years. And so I find him in this cave or something. He's doing his jewelry, whatever. I haven't seen the film in a long time, but I think that's what happens. So I find him. And then eventually I have to convince him to join forces again for me to try to solve these murders. But again, that scene, that Matt and I wrote that scene. Matt wrote most of the scene. And it was a very pivotal scene because it kind of tied everything together from our perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's why I think it had some semblance of having some type of order, because Gregory had it all over the place, you know, and I just believe that he was just trying to draw as many people as possible. And again, the money situation, he didn't have enough money. So it was like, you know, it was one of those types of things.
Yeah, because, I mean, at one point, aren't you guys, like, in, like, a spaceship or something at one point?
Yeah, because he, I guess he got a good deal on that set. Everything was based on money. And I think his excuse was that, okay, this is Samurai Cop, he's wild, everything, you know. But, you know, a lot of the loyalists, they didn't care for it because he really went away from the genre. They, you know, and having the porno stars, and again, I'm not a prude or anything.
Right.
But it really, I think it really hurt us because it kind of denigrates the movie.
Yeah, I mean, there is something like that when you're trying to bring a resurgence of something, but then you're not relying on the original people that made it work. It seemed like it was more of a stunt casting type issue, at least the way I see it.
Right.
You know?
Right. That's right on. That's exactly right on. That's exactly what happened, I believe. You know?
And I can only imagine what it would be like having to share a room with Tommy Wiseau.
Yeah, it's that's funny. Recently, I watched the Disaster Artist, which is James Franco was playing him.
Right.
Which I thought Franco did an excellent job playing him because he had him down to a T. My personal opinion, Tommy's not an actor. Tommy likes the glory. He, you know, again, I've heard different things about how he got the film made, which was different from what they showed on the screen at the end.
Right.
So I'm not going to question it, but I heard different things of how he got the money.
And we're not even going to talk about that.
So, you know, it was the oddest thing I've ever seen. You know, they had to read lines to him. It was just complete chaos again. And I just believe Greg wanted his audience, you know, the audience of the room. He wanted that audience.
Yeah, which I personally think wasn't that good of a fit for what I was hoping Samurai Cop 2 was going to be.
Right, exactly, yeah. That's the truth. While I'm thinking about this, I have to mention, while it's in my brain, is because, you know, what's happening with Samurai Cop, like I'm meeting with you now, talking with you. I've gotten some work. I'm working right now. And in fact, you know, we spoke the other day. Did you get a chance to see this thing? It's called Anti-Hero. Did you get a chance to look at it yet?
I actually went looking. I didn't see it. I personally couldn't find it when I went looking, but I'm really intrigued by this. If you can actually tell us a little bit about Anti-Hero.
Okay. The first episode started, I think, 2 days ago, yesterday or 2 days ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe you can find it by going on to YouTube.com.
Because I'm intrigued, because what I did find was a trailer and some behind-the-scenes stuff. And I did get to hear part of a voice session with you, because this is essentially a motion comic. It's an animated series.
Correct. Right. It's like a motion comic book. And I just talked with Dan Oles. He's the person that put all this together. And the reason why he thought of me was that because he saw the Samurai. He's a fan of the Samurai Cop movies. And he saw that scene I just told you about where I'm convincing Matt to come back to join me to fight the bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, this guy would be perfect to play this character in Anti-Hero. I'm playing a character by the name of Gregory Ditko. He's a henchman, an assassin. And he's trying to find his way to being a better human being. He gets married, has two sons, and that's probably about all I'll tell you. Again, it's going to be 12 episodes, and I just watched the first one, and it's done really, really well. I mean, I'm really proud to be a part of this. Dan is a very, very talented young man. When you see it, you'll see that it's drawn really well, and it's funny. It's like reading a comic book because, like, he has pages that are being turned.
Yeah,
as you see the characters, you know.
And I got to tell you, I think we had mentioned this beforehand too, when you and I first had met on the phone. I'm a huge mm-hmm. comic book fan, so once I heard more about what this was, like, I love animation and motion comic books, and there's some really great ones out there. And even me being able to hear just some of the sessions that you did, you got a phenomenal voice for voice acting. Is this the first thing that you've done like that, or have you done other projects too, where you were just vocal?
I've done a lot of voiceovers in New York, but I've never done anything like this before, where I'm playing a character with my voice. I've never done that. But I did voiceover commercials and stuff like that in New York, yeah.
Now, I always like getting the different responses from people, and I'll ask you a question I ask a lot of voiceover actors. What do you find personally different between acting in front of a camera physically and being behind a microphone acting that way? Do you find them similar, or are there differences?
The major difference is that you don't have to memorize anything. That's the major, you know, and I love that. You have the script right there, you know, and I've been acting for so long now. I've done so many plays and everything, really, because I'm a stage actor primarily. So I really got the acting thing down. So, you know, I just understand it so much more than, and it kind of just clicked in with me a number of years ago. And I really believe my stage acting and all the plays I've done has really helped me increase and augment as an actor. So that's the difference primarily, you know. I know the character well. In fact, Dan is so proficient, and he wrote a backstory for me, which most of the time that's an actor's job, but he even did that. And so, you know, I went in understanding this character, and so I had a really great time. In fact, this is one of the best times I'm having acting in my entire career, because Dan is, he's such an expert at what he's doing, and he's a young guy. And this is his first major project. He's done some other things, but this is his first major situation, and he's doing a really great job. It's a bit highbrow, which I like, because, you know, samurai cop movies aren't that highbrow. So, you know, I'm really enjoying this, Ken. I'm really having a good time doing this. Yeah.
Well, let me ask you a little bit more about this too, because I'm always interested by guys that do voiceover and animation. Is this something that you're doing it on a episode by episode basis, or has a huge chunk of this already been recorded on your end?
No, it's I've done two episodes. He's writing the third episode, so.
Oh, so it, the whole.
I don't know his time.
So yeah, so the whole thing is like a work in progress right now. So it's not like completely scripted. We're still in the middle of. Okay, cool.
Right. Yeah. It's all in his head, because he knows where the storyline is going, but it hasn't been written down. You know, but he knows where the character's going. He's got nine major characters. And it's, when you see it, you'll see there's a great cliffhanger. Like I said, I've done my second episode already. And that's basically all I know. He sent me the third episode, and I read it. That was a while back. But he just, you know, he's just, like I said, it's all in his head now. Because he knows where the characters are going. He just hasn't sat down and written it yet.
How often are you on the phone calling him saying, come on, get your ass in gear. I want to see more pages.
Well, we had a bit of a problem getting started, because, you know, he's using SAG people, and God, it was just so much mumble jumble he had to go through, and it was a little disheartening for him, you know. But he got it done. Everything is in order now. So, it, like I said, it's out there, and he's trying to build an audience. So everything's moving smoothly now. He wanted me to tell you, because I told him I was going to have another interview. He wants me to tell the public that, because most of it's done in black and white. And which I think it makes it stand out, but he says he's going to put color in some episodes down the line.
Oh, cool.
You know, to kind of, you know, spark it a little bit. But when you see it, you see it's a bit different. The drawings are different, and it's a good story thus far. You'll see, you'll get caught up in the story.
This project sounds so cool, and I know that in October, New York Comic Con is coming up, and that would be one of the perfect places to kind of spotlight the project. And maybe even even find a way to get you back up to Manhattan, and we could hang out for a weekend.
Sounds great, man.
You know,
stomping ground.
You know, yeah,
definitely.
You know, yeah. I think both of us have to pick up the phone and say, "Hey, dude, you got to get a table at New York Comic Con." It's one of the biggest stages of the year. Now, I know we are running out of time, and thank you for taking the time to talk with me today. I love our conversation so far, and I hope we can actually continue them moving forward.
Okay.
Let me ask you: is there anything else on the horizon that we should be looking out for?
Well, it's funny. I have another thing from Samurai Cop. It's a person by the name of Grayson Wolf. He's a filmmaker. He's out of Virginia. He's writing a script just for me.
So, get out. That's awesome.
Yeah. So he's in the process of doing that. And then what I'm planning to do when I get back to L.A., I really want to start getting involved with producing, you know. And so I got a script here that a friend of mine wrote. Called The Mayor of Harlem, based in New York, obviously, and we're talking about trying to get that going. So things look good, you know. Things look very good. And there's no, again, this notoriety that I'm receiving from Samurai Cop is it's definitely helping a lot of things. I'm becoming a celebrity, man. Can you imagine?
Hey, you know what? You already were in my eyes, dude.
Well, thanks a lot, Ken. Thanks. I appreciate
so,
it.
Hey, listen, for our audience out there, if they want to find out more about what's going on with you, is there any way that they can reach out to you?
Yeah, my main thing is Facebook. In fact, I guess that's how you got a hold of me. Yeah, I'm on Facebook practically every day. That's the only thing that I don't do Instagram, and I don't do Twitter. I just do Facebook, so they can find me on Facebook.
Mark, listen, once again, I want to thank you for spending the time with us tonight. The best of luck to everything you got going on right now. I cannot wait to see these episodes of Anti-Hero. And listen, dude, have a great night, and thanks again for everything.
All right.
All right.
Take care, brother.
You too.
All right, bye-bye.
He's a muscle-bound cop in the lady's wig and the bad-fitting baseball cap. See him driving round the city, running over bad guys in his Chevrolet piece of crap. On loan from San Diego,
you don't know why.
They call him Samurai.
His name is Joe,
but he doesn't fit the profile for a samurai. He doesn't even have a sword. Samurai cop.
He's telling me, son of a bitch, as he respects the Japanese of this country. He's gonna turn him into fertilizer while he's making time with the gang boss's lady.
Samurai cop.
At the cop shop, flirting with the lady cop and every other woman in the place, cause he can't stop. Now he's hitting on a nurse and he tells her he's a prize, cause it's Johnson's jumbo jet size.
His captain really hates
big
him.
Surprise.
He prays that he will die.
So do we.
He's killed at least a dozen people, but that doesn't seem to bother him at all. Samurai cop.
The evil drug lord wants to see his head on his piano, but I don't think that's very practical.
Samurai cop.
He's got a white piano, and to put a bloody head on a white piano's kind of tacky. Making dinner for his new girlfriend, wearing nothing but a little black banana hammock. They're gonna make sweet love, and it makes you kind of feel like you'd rather see anything else.
Now comes a final battle against the big chin guy. His wig is gone again, but suddenly his wig is back, and then his wig is gone. Samurai cop.
And now they drop their swords and they go back to punching, cause they're not very good with swords. Then the bad guy dies and you realize they didn't apprehend a single criminal. At the end he's back in his banana hammock. Tell me, is this any way to end a film?
I am super excited and happy tonight. Our next guest is actually Dan Oles. Dan, how are you?
Quite well, thank you.
You have a new project that I am really curious and excited about. It's a web series called Anti-Hero.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me a little bit about the project?
Well, it's similar to motion comics, which tend to be used for promotion, for movies, for video games. Basically, it's a comic book in which the panels have been animated, if only just slightly, and there's dialogue provided by voice actors and sound and music. It's animated
a very loose way, I would say.
Yeah, it's very loose way, yeah.
A lot of us, too, here on the network are fans of comic books, and when you go back and look at the old 60s and early 70s Marvel cartoons when they first originally did like Iron Man and the Hulk and Captain America, where they actually, it looked like they took the panels right out of the books and just kind of made sticks on those figures and move them around. but this is a lot more. This is a lot more today and current.
Yeah, it's not exactly clutch cargo, thankfully, but I did want the style to be somewhat close to that sort of Silver Age look. It's thematic for the stray line as well as, you know, for the production. So.
Well, I'll also jump in too. One of the reasons why I'm actually happy that you and I were able to talk. I previously had discussed this project with one of the actors in your film, Mark Fraser, and he gave
he gave a
glowing response to this when I had asked him about it, and it made me curious. And I actually got to see the first episode, and I thought it was fantastic. I think what you're doing is really, really cool. And one of the things I did want to ask, where did the concept and the idea come from?
Well, I've been trying to sort of field a movie for a while, but especially living in Seattle, that just wasn't feasible. Because here, although on occasion we've been sort of the film capital of the Northwest, recently it's been a little bit few and far between in terms of jobs, in terms of people interested in that sort of thing. So I figured instead I'd reach out to animators, I'd reach out to an artist. And I reached out to actors who were principally known for voice acting. Mark Fraser was kind and brave enough to give it a shot himself. He's done some voice acting, but mostly it was ADR. But I knew that he could pull it off because I'd seen his performances. I thought it was perfect for the character. Yeah, the main thing about the style was because it was what could conceivably be pulled together. The story's been sort of percolating in my head for some time, and I've written it down multiple ways. It's been about 14 years since I started sort of refining the ideas.
Could you give me a little bit of a synopsis of the story?
Oh, certainly. I've always been interested in the concept of superheroes as a sort of a psychological concept, not just a genre, because here are people that look like us but have superior abilities. And for their wish fulfillment in a genre context, you know, we all want to see what Iron Man is up till next. But in a realistic context, it's kind of terrifying to think that there are individuals that are more powerful than we are, and on a moment's notice, they could turn against us. Alan Moore's Watchmen very much sort of following that concept. But what interested me about Watchmen is that it took a much more optimistic perspective on that. I mean, as pessimistic as the story can be, the ultimate concept really was that there should be smart, very powerful people completely in charge of everything. And the story of Antihero came about when I was trying to think about what that might actually look like. What would happen if a city was failed to be saved by superheroes and the superheroes took over afterwards and then decided that really all the problems in the world are being caused by the governance of humanity? It was a way of analyzing universal themes, but through sort of a pop culture lens, and that's always appealed to me.
That's actually very cool. I mean, going back to some of the stories in that similar vein, I always think about Superman too, where you have the idea of the all-powerful being who everyone idolizes and is always there. But what happens if something does happen to him? You know, people tend to forget that he is an alien, and Lex Luthor tries to exploit that all the time to instill fear in people.
Yeah. If you've ever played the game Injustice: God Among Us.
Oh, yeah.
That had sort of tinges of that concept there. What if Superman basically took over the world? Except, again, there, the storyline sort of suggests that he was tricked or he was brainwashed or, you know, it's an alternate universe. And in Antihero, I don't give my characters that kind of easy way out. You know, the decisions they make are their own, which makes it sort of a character-based story, I guess.
Tell me a little bit about yourself, too. What were you doing before jumping in and finally getting Antihero together?
Well, I was editing movie trailers and music videos. I had just gotten off of film school, and I was making videos on YouTube to amuse myself, and I got a few offers from some California companies, which got me into the world of editing.
You and I are going to have to talk after this, because I've been trying that for years, and I got nothing.
Oh. Yeah. Well, I was doing something that wasn't exactly new, but I was doing it, I guess, differently. I would take movie trailers and I would edit them in such a way as for them to resemble trailers for books or films or video games that had not been made into films. So one of my proudest achievements is that I actually tricked the Guardian into using one of my trailers for the Hunger Games. The Hunger Games had been announced as a movie, and I edited together clips from a Russian film called The Inhabited Island, and they thought it looked so realistic that they actually put it up on their website. If you go to their one of their earlier articles, it actually says, "Retracted, we can no longer show this trailer because it isn't actually the official trailer."
That is funny. That is hysterical.
I think that might have got me a little recognition. I actually was interviewed for Kotaku at one point, or a site like that, and because there are some people that would take trailers and, you know, play with them or edit them, but I had this experience in film school, so I could do it fairly professionally. And eventually some people reached out to me and asked me to edit their movies, asked me to edit their trailers, their music videos.
So essentially it's guys like you that I have to blame for when I'm on YouTube and I'm getting teased and hitting clickbait on all these trailers that are supposed to be for upcoming movies, and they're absolutely not.
Some of those actually are trailers that people have borrowed from my channel and posted on their own to fool people.
Yeah.
But actually, all of my trailers, you can tell, are mine, because I always preface them with quotations and the word fake. So nobody gets confused.
So tell me a little bit about more of the collaboration of Anti-Hero. You got your voiceover actors involved. How did you actually pick the artist for the art style and come up with the look and feel of it?
Well, I purchased his comic. A Comic Drive-Thru is one of these websites that has a fair collection of comics for download in digital form, and I just really liked The Immortal. And so I sent out a message in several instances, that as well as when I reached out to Mark Frazier and when I reached out to Stephen Waite. I was lucky enough that I got a response. And Daryl Nickram has worked very close with me. He's done the concept artwork, and he's not afraid to take my ideas and put his own spin on them, which is really what I was looking for in collaboration anyway. You know, if you only have your own perspective, then it feels kind of like an echo chamber. So it's nice to reach out to somebody and say, "What about this?" And have them say, "No, I want to do this instead." And you go, "Yeah, well, that's a better idea anyway."
I did get to see the first episode. It is out, available now. I was actually fairly surprised. It does run a half hour. It's for an animated web show, it's kind of long. You know, normally when you see something like this, you know, it's normally like 10, 15 minute, you know, things, because I know the amount of work that it takes to make this. Was that a conscious choice that the episodes were going to run this long? Or is this something that you already had set? And God, I can only imagine how long it took just to get the first episode done.
Yeah, the first episode actually is even longer than that, but I cut it in half. the second episode will be sort of the second part of the first episode. But I decided that there was a clear ending point. You know, I've been playing this for a while, so basically the plot in my head is one continuous stream, but I cut it off at points where there were cliffhangers so that the story would feel a little bit more dynamic. Half an hour was not quite what I planned. It is fairly lengthy, but it was hard to say no to any of the performances that I'd received. There was a lot of exposition we get across in the first episode, so that later on the episodes can sort of coast. You know, if you understand the world and you understand the characters, then there doesn't have to be constantly people talking about the plot, which is the least interesting aspect of stories that I've been in.
Right. Yeah, I mean, and even with the voiceover stuff, I mean, it's got to kind of be a blessing and a curse, I would think, because it's not like you actually have to have the actors right there and available to you. I mean, because some of them actually do live on the other side of the country. And,
yes.
You know, I'm assuming that they're in studios recording their lines and then sending them back to you. How critical are you on the files when you receive them? Like, do you guys talk in advance about how the character should be? Or is it something that you let them go with and then you send back criticism and feedback? How does that work?
Yeah, six of one, half a dozen of the other, because in some instances, I've actually been lucky enough to get people into a local studio and direct them from behind the glass. So I can actually ask them to do retakes and things like that. And the people who do the performances elsewhere are also professional enough to do multiple takes, which is very useful if, for instance, they tend to mispronounce a word, or there's a different attitude that's required in a sequence. And if I really do need another take, I just write a message and ask them to do a retake. Nothing too extensive usually, but if it's like, this sequence should have had you sounding more surprised, or this should make you feel a little bit more angry or something like that, just to make sure that the story works. Everyone's been pretty good about it.
Did you find that it was a constant thing, or were the guys just that good that it was just something that would happen periodically?
They're that good. But the people that I'm working with have had years of experience, oftentimes in video games or films.
Mm-hmm.
Mark Fraser, actually, I've been working very close with, because the two of us have sort of collaborated on how his character should go. So part of existence of his character that he plays is due to his own input and his own suggestions. We basically create Greg Ditko together.
You know what? I'm going to stop you there, too. I'm going to stop you there, too, because you actually brought up the main character's name, which I think is brilliant. Can you tell us a little bit about the genesis of the main character and where the name came from?
Yeah. Well, it's a sort of a superheroes, and I the main character, I wanted to be sort of a beacon of what superheroes used to be. And so his name is Stan Lee Ditko, which, of course, is a play on Stan Lee and Steve Ditko, the creators of Spider-Man and some of the original artists of Marvel. So his attitude is very sort of in that golden age, in that he believes that superheroes should be forthright, upright people, compared to actually other characters that express different opinions that are also tend to be named after comic book authors. His boss, for instance, name is Alan Miller, which is a combination of Alan Moore and Frank Miller.
Yep.
So he tends to be a little bit more cynical about the situation.
Nice.
that there's little things here and there. The city's called Excelsior, and there actually is a True Believers reference, but it's a little sinister because the villain mentions it, which I thought was potentially interesting. The villain and his psychic, by the way, also have an interesting thing about their names. Schuster, the creator of Superman.
Yep.
Based his story on an older comic that was called Rise of the Superman, where Superman is a villain rather than a hero.
Right.
He was this telekinetic guy, and his name was William Dunn, or Billy Dunn, I guess, in the original, which I think is actually why Bruce Willis's character is named Dunn in Unbreakable.
I never thought of that. That's actually pretty clever if that was, you know, the original concept.
Yeah. I mean, he's sort of similar in that he's this, you know, product of happenstance who has superior powers. But the evil scientist in that storyline is named Ernest Smalley. And so that's the name that I gave to my sort of lead villain character, the administrator. The character is played by Stephen Wade.
Awesome. Now, actually, let me ask you, too. You essentially have 2 half-hour shows completed or ready. Mm-hmm. You know, we have the first one out. The second one, I'm assuming, is almost ready to come out.
Yeah, I need the artwork for it. The artist is taking a little bit of a break, but, you know, all the dialogue has been recorded for it.
Once those first two episodes are in the can and released, like, where do you go from here? What's the next step?
Well, I have 12 episodes planned. There's no real schedule because, you know, really they come out when I have the funding to do them. So every episode or so, I'm going to be sort of putting up a Kickstarter. Right now I have a Patreon. I'm going to meet with my board of directors actually next week and discuss additional funding for the project so that we can have a little bit more of a regular schedule when it comes to putting out these episodes.
Since the release, has there been any reception that you've gotten yet about the project?
People who have seen it have enjoyed it, and there actually was a Reddit for a while of people discussing it. It's been fairly muted, but I think that's just because it's a little difficult to find. The title that we chose, Antihero, is evocative of the storyline, but perhaps not the easiest thing in the world to find on YouTube because it might be a little too generic, I guess.
Right.
Also, as you pointed out, it's a little unusual, so people aren't really sure what it is, I think. I'm thinking of doing a website at some juncture that advertises it and sort of collects the episodes and pieces and things like that. And I have put together a Twitter for the concept. So,
right.
And we reach out to the show. So,
cool. You know, it looks like there are a little bit of issues with the with being able to find it. But for those that are interested, because it is worth it, I did get to see the first episode again. I love it. I can't wait to see more. Where can we direct our audience to actually check it out?
If you go to my sort of normal YouTube page, Blood Runs Clear, I have the trailer on that page, as well as a link to the Patreon, to the Twitter, to the episode in the description for that trailer. And I do have an official anti-hero YouTube page now, which has the trailer as well as the first episode, which you can see for free.
And we'll have links in the description of the episode here on our website as well for everybody.
Thank you.
So, Dan, listen, I'm gonna let you go. It has been a pleasure. Okay. I am so excited about this. I can't wait to hear more. And I just can't wait to hang out with you after this so we can just talk comics in general a little bit more, you know?
Sure. That was very good.
You know, we had the opportunity to talk previously before this, and I think you and I spent over an hour just talking about, like, classic comic books. And it was one of the greatest conversations I ever had with someone I had never talked to in my life.
Yeah, it's a passion. So, you know, I was happy to be able to talk about it.
So, listen, again, thank you very much, Dan. The project is Anti-Hero. Check it out. You won't be disappointed. Thanks, Dan, and have a great night.
Thank you. You too.
This has been a Non-Productive Media presentation. Executive producer, Frank Hablawi. This program and many others like it on the Non-Productive Network is distributed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. Please share it, but ask before trying to change it or sell it. For more information, visit non-productive.com.